yourself a song to sing and say till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Sing the robber burns straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about the election. And before that, though, a little bit of our overview of some important developments in this past week. And we'll see what's coming next week will be very important. And then we're going to talk about the legacies of the two leading candidates. Well, sort of leading candidates here. Particularly, you know, you hear all both sides, the Democrats, they keep referring to Bill Clinton. Oh, those were the great years, the golden years. We had jobs and so on and so forth. Well, what's Bill Clinton's real record? And then the Republicans, you know, they genuflect to Ronald Reagan like he was the secular god of politics in America here, and we're all going to go back to Reagan and make things great again. So we hear these two presidents sort of put up on pedestals, and each one is given a special place in the pantheon of presidential politicians in America. Well, we're going to look at their records and really see what their legacies were. And are they very different? You know, are they the same? You know, was one worse than the other? Well, we're going to look at that. But first, a little round table here. And then at the very end, we will sort of think about the unthinkable. And that is, what happens after the conventions? Or during the conventions, and what happens after the conventions. That's what's really going to be interesting, I think. Because it's pretty clear that the Republican establishment does not want Trump. They're doing, at least a certain group of them, are doing all they can to dump Trump. And that may backfire on them, but it's going to be very interesting on the Republican side in that regard. And also on the Democratic side, it looks like Hillary's going to get it. Big surprise. With all her special delegates, all the party hacks lined up behind her before, makes it almost impossible for anyone to challenge the Democratic Party establishment, even though Sanders is making a decent run at it, pretty much defeated before he ever began. And we'll look at that. And what's going to happen there? Because the Democrats' big problem is voter turnout. People who supported them time and time again, and Mr. Jello Barack Obama, did not deliver. That's pretty darn clear, did not deliver, sitting back and thinking about his career more than the people. And we didn't get very much out of Obama. And we can see, if you look at the turnouts here in past elections from 2010, a little return, one more hope in 12, the last hope, 2012, 14, bad turnout. And you look at all the youth vote that's going for Sanders here, and my guess is you're not going to get the youth vote turnout for the Democrats once Hillary gets the nomination. That can be very significant. It might make a difference. And I think people are underestimating Donald Trump, who looks more and more like Ronald Reagan in some ways, the 1980 election. And we'll talk about that at the end. But first, a little round robin here of what the key developments economically, internationally have been this past week. And then we'll look at the legacies of Clinton and Reagan. And then we'll talk a little bit, speculate a little bit on these thoughts out of the box in an unpredictable election year. Okay, what's been happening? Well, it's interesting to see the dueling Fed governors here the past week. one of them, you know, they come out, they give signals, not Janet Yellen. The other ones are, you know, they decide who's going to say what, and they come out and make their statements. Well, you got one set of them, Dudley and others, saying, oh, well, the U.S. economy is not too hot here. We got to be careful. There's global winds blowing, and they're blowing our way, and we got to be very careful about the economy going forward. And then, of course, the other side says, oh, no, the U.S. economy is exceptional. It's doing so well, and I don't know why people are so concerned about the economy. It's so well. You know, so you got dueling Feds. You know, we got dueling QEs between Japan and Europe, but within the U.S. we have dueling Fed statements here. What is it? What is the state of the U.S. economy? Well, the numbers just came out today for jobs for February. And, oh, well, you know, 242,000 jobs. But it's the same old story. You look at those numbers. Where are the jobs being created? Healthcare and retail. Retail and restaurants and so on. Those are all part-time jobs. Those are low-paid jobs. Those are jobs without any benefits. You know, if you look at the wages of American workers, they haven't gone anywhere in 15 years. Well, no wonder people are pissed off. You know, okay, so they got crummy jobs. It's better than no job, but it's still a crummy job. And after 15 years, American people are getting tired of the same old situation of the very wealthy and the corporations and people playing stock and bond markets getting filthy rich, and everyone else is at best treading water or worse. You know, 15 years of that, come on. No wonder people are desperate and expressing their desperation by voting and supporting Sanders and Trump. Anybody who's anti-Washington, anti-Democratic Republican Party establishment, are the folks who are turning behind Trump and Sanders. It's a significant group. And the big question is, what's that group going to do if and when they get denied in this election cycle? What are they going to do? We're probably going to see a spate of third-party efforts, nascent, very beginning, because people are upset, but they're still willing to work within the two-party system to see if they can reform and change that two-party system, but they're not going to be able to. Then the question is going to be, what are they going to do? We'll see after the nominating conventions here. It's going to be a very interesting period, and it may be the beginning of something new in American politics. It may not, but it may. Okay, so back to Ron Robin here. Dueling Fed statements. Interesting here. How well is the U.S. economy going? And we still keep getting these numbers of crummy job creation. All right, so, and what else? Well, we're getting all kind of signals out of the Europe, the European Central Bank, which will announce next week, I've been predicting, a further QE, liquidity injection. They'll buy either more bonds or extend another year their pledge to buy bonds in Europe. I don't know where you're going to get them because a lot of these bonds have been bought up already in Europe. There's not that many for them to buy given the scope and magnitude of this announced program. So next week we're going to have the next iteration in the dueling QEs coming out of Europe. Europe is a basket case. I also am going to predict that the UK will leave the European Union. Brexit, as they call it, British exit. It's pretty darn close even now. But when they have their voting in June, I think it's going to go slightly. Unless they manipulate the vote, Cameron and his buddies, which they kind of did in the Scottish independent vote here. They may do the same. But nonetheless, I think we're going to see an exit because they've unleashed a opened Pandora's box over there, Cameron has. You know, he pledged in pandering to everybody in his election here that he would have this vote on staying in the European Union or not. And when he got elected, then he had to deliver the vote. And oh, now he's trying to corral the beast here. He's got a tiger by the tail. And he and his big bank and big corporate buddies there are trying to put it back in the box. And they're having difficulty because the people have gained nothing. You know, the British workers gain nothing from this EU thing. You know, it's British exporters, it's British businesses. And what they do gain is, you know, wild migration back and forth within the, it's called the Schengen system here. Anybody, workers can go anywhere, so all these workers from Eastern Europe flooded into the UK. And then at the same time, you get the British Commonwealth workers from Asia, South Asia, and elsewhere flooding into the UK. And now you got the mass migrations from North Africa and the Middle East, and even now further down in Africa, coming into Europe all at once. So you got a problem in Europe. They can't get the economy going. You got massive debt still sitting on balance sheets and banks, and banks being unstable, $1.5 trillion in non-performing loans in the economy over there. So they got a big problem to begin with economically. They're in a chronic stagnation since 2008 over there in Europe. And on top of that, now you got British exit as an issue, and you got this mass migrations coming, which is the product of U.S. neocon policies in North Africa and the Middle East, which the U.S. has dragged the Europeans along with, and now they're paying the price for all these interventions in Libya and Syria and so forth. We have people becoming a factor in these mass migrations, big political factor, not political organized, but the masses are playing a role here, and they're pounding on Europe's doors. Let us in, let us in. We can't stand it here, this perpetual warfare in the Middle East. You know, we want out, and we want in, and there's just too many of them. It's just a flood. Europe can't absorb them, but it's going on, and it's a political factor there of major dimensions, major. And all that combined means Europe is a very unstable place, and we see the nascent rise of proto-fascist movements all over Europe now as a result. You know, that seems like that fascism thing is in the European DNA, and whenever their immune system collapses, as it is now, up comes fascism here. And I mean real fascism. I don't mean, you know, the way they throw that word around here in the U.S., you know, authoritarian politicians and so forth are called fascists. That's not fascism. Fascism is a social movement. And that's what's brewing once again. It's well brewed already in Ukraine, of course. And it's beginning to reappear elsewhere in Europe. So Europe is a basket case. And then on the other side of the world, we've got this churning going on in China. You know, China has these bubbles, financial bubbles, and their economy is slowing, and they even have more non-performing loans, some estimate $5 trillion of non-performing loans. And, well, they got a couple trillion dollars in cash over there that they can throw, and they're throwing it. They're throwing it at that stock market collapse, and they're throwing it to try to maintain their currency from collapsing. But a lot of speculators around the world are betting that the China currency cannot be sustained at its current levels, and it will devalue again. It already has, but the Chinese are trying to, as part of their agreement with the IMF to make the yuan a global currency, they're trying to maintain that currency, because if it keeps falling, they they, the Chinese, will experience even greater capital flight. $1 trillion has flowed out of China in the past year. You know, those investors in the stocks and currencies, when the stock market declines and the currency declines, the people want to get out of that particular currency, sell it, and take their money out. And, of course, selling it, selling the stock, selling the yuan, causes it to decline even further. And behind that is the problems in Chinese real economy and all those old-line industrial companies that are technically bankrupt, and the government just keeps them going. Although there are signs now they're going to start allowing some to collapse. And, ooh, that's going to have a big risky thing over there in China, because the Chinese workers, you know, they get upset. They don't sit back and watch their television. They take to the streets. So they're playing with fire over there in China and doing everything they can to keep their currency from falling further and keep that stock market from imploding too fast. But that takes a lot of foreign reserves of currencies to do that, and they're spending by hundreds of billions every month to prop up that stock market. Although it's looking like they're coming up with a new plan over there in China. You know, they announced their umpteenth stimulus program here, which has more psychological effect than anything, and you get a little boost or a little respite in the collapse. But they also look like they're encouraging the money coming out of the stock market to go back into local property. You know, that's an interesting 180-degree turn, because 2 years ago, in 2013-14, Chinese policymakers did just the opposite. They had a property housing construction bubble going, financial bubble going, and to try to divert the bubble, they couldn't stop it. Every time they tried to stop it, they slowed down the economy. So they decided, the Chinese decided, they're going to try to divert some of that speculative money out of property into the stock market. Well, we got a bubble in the stock market. And then the bubble in the stock market imploded here, and the money started flowing out of the country. So now they're trying to redirect that capital flow out of stocks away from capital flight and currency sales back into property. So there, you know, I got a chapter in my book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy, called China, Bubble, Bubble, Toil and Trouble. China has a triple bubbles, and what they're doing is not resolving them. What they're doing is bubble whack-a-mole, financial whack-a-mole going on, and all they can do is divert the bubbles from one to the other and back again. Unable to really get rid of the massive debt, $25 trillion in debt, total debt increase in China since 2010. $25 trillion boggles the mind. And it's probably more than that, and that's what it was last year when I wrote the book. Anyway, if you're interested in China or Europe, I have specific chapters on that in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, and you can go and read those chapters. Go to my website, or my blog, blogjackrasmus.com, or to the website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOS Productions.com. And you can order the book there at discount. You can get to it through my blog as well, jackrasmus.com. There are book icons, book photo jacket icons. Just click on them and it'll take you there. Or you can go to Clarity Press, the publisher. Okay. By the way, talking about books, I have a new book coming out here this May called Looting Greece, The New Financial Imperialism. Yeah, we have a new form of colonialism going on within the advanced economies developing, and it's based on financial wealth extraction, and how they're doing that in Greece is a good example of what's coming in the smaller countries in the advanced economies. G20, smaller countries. Look for Loot in Greece. That's coming out. And then I've just contracted as well for later in the year to produce another book called Central Banks on the Ropes? Central Bank Monetary Policy has failed, and the good indicator that failure is the turning to negative interest rates, which are going to cause them more problems than resolution. They're desperate. Central banks are desperate. All their moves have failed and are failing. They can't get the global economy going again. It's slowing. We're already in a global trade recession and a global industrial production recession. The only thing keeping these economies up barely is services, and that's very speculative as to the numbers that we got, whether how accurate they are in services. Anyway, we'll be talking about China, watching China here and their moves to try to put the tiger back in the cage. And we'll be looking at the European Central Bank next week. And on the 15th, 16th as well, the Fed will decide whether it will raise interest rates again or not. And then the fourth interesting thing last week was the oil deal. It looks like there's some tentative deal between Russia, Saudi Arabia, and perhaps backdoor the U.S. On trying to prevent oil prices from collapsing further. You know, they fell into the mid-20s, $20 per barrel in some places, $15 per barrel here early last month, and now they've recovered to the mid-30 range. They're desperately trying to get the price per barrel up to about 50. We'll see how that turns out. But all those things, the promise of ECB, more injection, the promise of China, another stimulus, and declaration they won't let the yuan fall further, and this tentative oil deal has had the effect of boosting the markets this past week or month here, the oil markets, you know, the stock markets and so forth. It's just another short-term blip up, followed, I'm sure, by other blips down. You know, the stock market, U.S. Dow, is back up to 17,000. Now it was down to 15 something, I think, or sort of low 16s. But you know, it's all institutional buying. 75% of all the stock buying is done by institutional traders and speculators. You know, it's all indexed and so forth. You know, there's very little individual buying of stocks anymore. It's a fixed market. I don't pay much attention to the stock market. It doesn't mean much. Okay, so let's move on, and let's talk about the presidential legacies. You know, Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. As I said earlier, we get this holy of holy attitudes towards these two presidents as to what they accomplished, and they're held up as guiding lights of what should be done here and what I will do. You hear all these Republicans when they're not talking over each other and shouting at each other and calling each other names. You know, what a circus, what a show, American politics, electoral politics. What a decay of the whole thing. And you see them talking, trying to, wear the hat of Reagan, every one of them. I'm going to be more Reagan than your Reagan, or my Reagan is bigger than your Reagan, or whatever, you know, that kind of nonsense. We hear that every time they get up on the stage. You know, I'm going to be Make America Great Again, just like Ronald Reagan did. Well, what's Ronald Reagan's economic legacy? Well, you know, what really happened under those years, 1980 to 88? Well, let me give you some facts here, and then you can decide how great Reagan was. Oh, by the way, he was very great to the wealthiest 1%. And those are the folks that are singing his praises, of course. And, but how did he do for the rest? Okay, let's look here. During Reagan's term in office, average hourly wages in real wages in 1982 dollars actually declined. When adjusted for inflation, average hourly wages over 8 years declined They were $7.93 in 1980. By 1988, the real wage was $7.79. Yeah, it was actually less at the end than when Reagan came in office. And the same thing for weekly earnings, you know. Weekly earnings is how many hours you work times how what your hourly wage is. And what happened there? Well, this even more so. Weekly earnings, when Reagan came into office, were $281.21. When he left office, it was $270.32. So weekly earnings and hourly wages over 8 years, I mean, this is a long time, you got a chance to raise them, actually declined. How about the minimum wage? Was that adjusted for people at the bottom? No. 8 years, no adjustment in the minimum wage at all. When Reagan came into office, the minimum wage was equivalent to $6.55 an hour, you know, what it could buy. When he left office, it was $4.80, adjusted for inflation. In other words, if you were at the bottom of the wage heap, you know, and there's tens of millions of people there, you had to absorb a 27% wage cut under Reagan. 27%. So the average, you know, had a 14-cent wage cut. I don't know what is that. That's 3-4% cut. But if you were at the bottom, 27%. 27. And what about the wealthiest 10% and 1% and 1/10 of 1% households? How did they do? Well, the wealthiest 10% saw their share of the income, total income in the country, go up from 32 to 39%. So if you were in the top 10%, you know, you did well under Reagan. You got a 7% of the all the income went to you, 39%, right? Two-thirds of that, by the way, went to the wealthiest 1%, two-thirds. Okay, so two-thirds of 39, you know, is what, 26%? So the wealthiest 1% got 26% of all the income. 26% of all the income, so 1%. Now, by the time we get to Bill Clinton, the wealthiest 1% got 45% of all the income gains during Clinton's 8 years. So they got 26% during Reagan's years. That almost doubles to 45%. When we get to George Bush, it's 65% of all the income gains during the boom years of George. And then under Barack Obama, it's 97% of all the income gains, the wealthiest 1%. They go from 26% under Reagan to 97% under Barack Obama. And it's a trend, an undisputable trend. Well, no wonder we got income inequality in this country. The wealthiest 1% have been stuffing their pockets ever since Ronald Reagan, and it begins with him, you know, from 32 to 39%, and then Bill Clinton, 45%. And then George Bush, 65, and then Barack Obama, 97. And by the way, these numbers are academic numbers. They're from Emmanuel Saez, a professor at UC Berkeley, and the work he's been doing for years, based on IRS data. I mean, you can't get any better than IRS data of who's making what. And, of course, even the IRS data doesn't include people who and the wealthy who do shelter their money and don't report it to the IRS. So, you know, these numbers are even worse than the IRS for sure. But even the IRS data shows this horrible income increase from the 1%. Well, under Ronald Reagan, you know, the whole process started where the wealthy get all that income. By the way, the wealthiest 1/10 of 1% of the households under Reagan tripled their share of income. Tripled. All right. So it all begins under Ronald Reagan. You know, the wealthiest 1% share of all the national income from the early 1940s, in the war, it was leveled, and it was like 8 to 9%. All that period from roughly 1942 to about 1978, 79, 80, it was the wealthiest 1% got 8 to 9% of all the national income. So the whole thing starts under Ronald Reagan in terms of income inequality. And it's been going on ever since. And I don't know, can they, you know, is Hillary, if she's elected, she going to make sure they get 101% of all the income gains? You know, she's certainly hyping her hubby Bill's record, you know, and it will be no different. Hillary's programs will be no different. It's all part of what sometimes is called the neoliberal establishment. Okay. How about corporate profits? How did they do under Reagan? Excuse me. Well, in the 1950s, average corporate profits were 7.5% of income, corporate income. In the 1970s, they dropped because 1970s was a crisis decade, just like the current, to 6.6%. But under Ronald Reagan, they shot back up to 9.5%. So corporate profits did well. You know, they increased, you know, from 6.6 to, on average, to 9.5% on average. A lot of those corporate profits were the result of big tax cuts under Ronald Reagan. He started this big tax cut thing for the wealthy. You know, the U.S. GDP was about $4 trillion at the time. And he proposed a $752 billion tax cut based upon a $4 trillion U.S. GDP. I mean, that's even more massive than what George W. Bush did. And more massive than Obama did, you know, $787 billion on a $14 trillion GDP in 2009. Well, Ronald Reagan, $752 on a $4 trillion GDP. He dropped the top tax rate for the top bracket there, the wealthiest 5%, from what was about 59% top tax rate, 59%, to 35%. In other words, he almost halved it, halved the tax rate. I'm talking about the personal income tax and the corporate income tax, down to 35% from 60% to 35%, right? And then he passed this investment tax credit, which had a lot to do with the offshoring. In other words, take your jobs offshore, Mr. Corporation, and we'll give you a tax cut for building, investing offshore rather than in the U.S., right? You don't even have to prove you created jobs. You know, when the investment tax credit was created under JFK, the company got a 7% tax cut, investment credit, if they showed they created jobs with it. Well, by the time we got to Nixon, you get the 7%, you don't have to show jobs. And then we get to Reagan, and oh, well, you can claim this for offshore. Investment tax credit for offshore investment. Well, that was just a big incentive to move jobs offshore, which, of course, we know they did. So taxes, big tax cuts trend for the wealthy and corporations begins under Ronald Reagan. You know, no wages and wage cuts under Reagan. Big income shift under Reagan. Corporate profits shoot up under Reagan. Big tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations under Reagan. These are all trends, of course, that are dominant today, but they begin with Reagan. How about jobs under Reagan? Well, with Reagan, we see the big trend begin of contingent labor. Contingent labor meaning part-time temp jobs. Right? Before that, there was a standard amount of people that were voluntary part-time, didn't want to work, and that was pretty stable for decades, didn't change. But under Reagan, we get this huge increase beginning in contingent jobs, involuntary part-time jobs, rose in his first term in office, 80 to 84, from 3.4 million to 6 million. 6 million. Half of all the jobs created were involuntary part-time jobs during Reagan's first term. And temp jobs increased fourfold. Now, you know, part-time jobs, temp jobs pay about 60% of a full-time job and 10 to 20% in terms of benefits. So corporations, after the big 81-82 recession, which was engineered by Reagan to reduce inflation caused by the oil companies and OPEC and the Saudis, you know, they're the ones who jacked up the oil prices, caused inflation. Well, people had to pay for that inflation by losing their jobs and cutting spending. So they made us pay for this arrangement between U.S. big oil and big Saudi money, and we had to pay for it. Well, that was Ronald Reagan's first recession there, you know, where he purposely engineered a recession by raising interest rates to 18%, you know, and that's prime rates. So auto rates and home rates, mortgage rates, were into 20%. Well, that brought the whole manufacturing and construction industries in the U.S. to a halt overnight, you know, caused a big recession in 1981-82. Well, recovery from that recession, when it did occur in 83-84, was virtually all contingent jobs, or at least half of them, you know, voluntary part-time temp jobs. 3.7 million manufacturing jobs were lost. It was during this period, too, that the full-time jobs went offshore, started going offshore. You know, so we got part-time temp jobs. Well, I just said at the beginning of the show that our recent numbers here and our job numbers today show virtually all those industries where you have part-time. I mean, retail is all part-time now. So is pretty much, you know, restaurants and entertainment and so forth. That's all part-time. I don't know what the part-time numbers are in healthcare, but we still have some expansion there in healthcare going on. How long it's going to be is anyone's guess, right? We also had the first free trade deal under Ronald Reagan. Yeah, Canada was brought in 1988, you know, setting the precedent here for more and more free trade. You know, in terms of jobs, we got all these contingent part-time temp jobs. We lost 3.7 million manufacturing jobs. We got interest rates of 18 to 20-some percent. We got offshoring. We got trade deficits, and free trade. You know, the U.S. Commerce Department has estimated for every 1 billion of trade deficit, $1 billion of trade deficit, in other words, we import more than we export, we lose 15,000 jobs for every $1 billion of trade deficit, 15,000 jobs. Well, it's Ronald Reagan who sets up this a huge trade deficit that keeps growing and growing during his term, and of course, we've had a problem ever since, trade deficit. And the trade deficit allows them, the politicians, to run a budget deficit, because part of this trade deal that was worked out in the 1980s was with the, you know, the Japanese and the Europeans and smaller countries fell in line was what I call the twin deficits. What is that? That's where there's an agreement. We will run a trade deficit with you. You are the countries. In other words, we'll buy more of your stuff, which is really a lot of American companies moving offshore and sending the stuff back cheap. We'll buy your stuff. We'll buy more of your stuff than you buy of our stuff. What that means is that there's a net outflow of U.S. dollars into these countries, into China, Japan, Europe, Middle East. Right? But the agreement is you folks will recycle that money back to us. You will buy our treasury bonds, and we'll let you pick up, you know, some properties and companies here and there, you know, that aren't strategic will let you do that as well, but mostly buying treasury bonds. So the money flows back. All the dollars that flow out because of the trade deficit flow back to the U.S., which allows the U.S. to run a budget deficit. Budget deficit, you know, meaning that our tax revenues are less than our spending. But the difference is made up with this money flowing back. And the more money that flows back, the bigger budget deficit we can run. Well, why do we get the budget deficit? Because we're going to cut the taxes for the rich. And we're going to spend more on war. So war spending and tax cuts for the rich cause the budget deficits. But the budget deficits are financed by the recycling of money that occurs because we have these trade deficits allowed. You know, Reagan and Baker and his buddies got together and met with the Japanese and Europeans. It was called the Plaza Accord in 1985, Plaza Hotel in New York, and got this deal going with the Japanese. And then the Louvre Accords in Europe the following year. This is how this twin deficit thing has been set up that allows us to run bigger and bigger budget deficits caused by giving bigger and bigger tax cuts to the rich and keep playing war games. Okay, so that's, you know, that begins under Reagan, too, and it's continued ever since. How about pensions? How about pensions? What's Reagan's legacy on pensions? Oh, well, Reagan gave us the 401k plans. It begins under Reagan, 401k plans. All right? And millions and tens of millions of U.S. workers were converted by their employers from having true defined benefit plans, pension plans, and substituted with 401k plans. You know, a true defined benefit plan, of which there are some left, not many, most of them in the private, some big companies and the public sector. Defined benefit plans are where you're guaranteed a certain pension every month based on your years of service and your income. You're guaranteed that. You will receive those benefits all the rest of your life. The 401k, there's a pot of money, and you know, you can invest it in your company stock and lose it all. Right, or the stock market, you know, where the company says, we'll put some money, it's a contribution plan, pension contribution, not a pension benefit plan. And we'll put some money in it, maybe, we, the company, and when we want, we won't put money in. You know, that's your responsibility. And, of course, Wall Street gets to manipulate those 401k plans because it's all held with Wall Street programs. And they skim off the top of that. So this big conversion from real pensions to defined benefit pensions begins under Reagan as well. Tens of thousands of defined benefit pensions were eliminated. But that's not the half of it here. Under Reagan, we have decisions that the money that was still there in defined benefit plans is no longer workers' wages. It's the property of the company. Therefore, the company can do what they want if there's a surplus in the defined benefit pension plan. You know, for example, Exxon paid for its oil spill out of its pension plan. Took the workers' money to pay for its oil spill up there in Valdez, Alaska. And it was chronic skimming off the top of these defined benefit pension plans. Companies just took the money out, you know, and later on, of course, the plans go broke because the money was taken out. United Airlines takes out $287 million during Reagan's period alone, Goodyear $400 million. It was skimming off the top, and it stimulated this acquisition thing, junk bond acquisition financial Ponzi scheme. Where Raider companies, you know, like Carl Icahn and all those guys would take over a company just to get its hands on the defined benefit pension surplus, keep the surplus money, break up the rest of the company, and sell it off. And there was a great movie in the 1980s called Wall Street with Michael Douglas, and just about that exact thing. Right? So Reagan gives us the destruction of pension plans. He gives us part-time temp jobs and offshoring of jobs and free trade and deficits and twin deficits that allow big tax cuts for the rich and more war spending. He's responsible under his watch for wages, real wages, declining precipitously and income wealth of the 1% rising just as fast. Big tax cuts, record tax cuts. How about Social Security? Well, he starts out trying to go after Social Security, but he's not able to pull it off. So he puts Alan Greenspan in charge of a commission, and Alan Greenspan jacks up the payroll tax and indexes it to inflation, so that Social Security now creates a budget trust fund surplus of trillions of dollars, trillions of dollars. No, they said, well, you know, the baby boomers are coming. Yeah, they're coming now. And we need this surplus. But what does the government do? It borrows from that surplus to partly pay for the deficits that it's running. Yeah, trillions of dollars has been borrowed, taken out of the Social Security Trust Fund, and IOU treasuries are put in there, not real money, and the government spends it. It's IOUs there, and they say, oh, we can always put it back. Yeah, and then they got to raise other bonds to put it back. Trillions of, you think they're going to do that? No, they're not going to do that. And housing, we have the savings and loan speculative boom and bust. We had the junk bond boom and bust. In other words, we have all this financial deregulation begins under Reagan. Under Reagan, we have this whole move to deregulate controls on international capital flows, which sets the foundation for this big speculative financial boom in the 90s and afterwards. And, of course, that cost the government $300 billion to bail out the savings and loans. Okay, so that's a Reagan. I can go on for hours here. Terrible legacy that all these Republican candidates are really holding up as the thing that should be the result here if they get elected. Well, what about Bill Clinton? What about him? Well, is he a continuation, or was he something different? Were his times really all that good? Well, let's look at his record. As I said earlier, 45% of all the income gains went to the wealthiest 1% under Reagan's watch, 92 to 2000. 45%. In other words, an increase from the 39% at the end of the Reagan period here. The stock market rises, S&P 500 rises 234% under Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton cuts the capital gains tax for the rich from 28% to 20%. Executive pay rises from $4.5 million on average CEO pay to $11.1 million, a gain of 342%. At the beginning of Clinton's term, average CEOs are making 90 times the pay of their average worker. By the end, they're making 300 times the pay of the average worker. And what about workers' pay? Oh, yeah, okay, it rose, but in 1982 dollars, just for inflation over the entire 8 years, it rises only 5.8%. 5.8%. Executive pay rises 342%, and worker pay rises 5.8%, adjusted for inflation. Minimum wage, okay, so the minimum wage buys 4 cents an hour more over his term. 4 cents. It goes from $5.46 spending power here to $5.50. Right. Workers, and that's all absorbed, you know, that paltry 5.8% wage increase is absorbed in higher premium payments, out-of-pocket payments for health care under Bill Clinton, right? In 1993, when he's first year in office, there's a tax hike, but the top 10% are exempted from the tax hike. The top 10%, wealthiest 10%, don't pay any tax hikes. Don't pay any more taxes. but you know, the rest of the folks do. And then the big tax cut in 1997 under Bill Clinton, the inheritance, the estate tax is the exemption is almost doubled. The corporate rate, the effective corporate rate, what corporations pay in a corporate income tax, declines from 18% to 12%. And by the end of his term, 2000, no fewer than 63% of all corporations in the U.S. were paying no taxes. Yeah. In other words, the template that he creates of big cuts in the state tax and personal income tax and corporate taxes and so forth, right? This template is what George W. Bush will take and blow wide open. And the precedent is under Bill Clinton. How about jobs, you know? We see under Clinton here we have this accelerating income gains and stagnating wages. Okay, under Reagan we had a big collapse in wages, real wages. Under Bill Clinton we have a stagnation of wages. But at the same time we have the rich getting richer, richer, richer. Right, and it's, a lot of it has to do with allowing all the speculation, financial speculation and offshoring and so forth continuing, and big tax cuts for corporations and wealthy investors in the interim. But what about jobs? We hear, oh, well, we created all these jobs under Bill Clinton. You know, we want to go back to those golden years of Bill Clinton, job creation. Well, what's the record on jobs, right? Well, first of all, contingent jobs, part-time temp jobs, did increase. We did create jobs, but 5 million of them were contingent jobs. Contingent jobs rose from 22 million to 27 million at the end of his term. So, yeah, he created jobs, 5 million part-time temp jobs. And what about jobs lost? Well, you know, he gave us free trade. He really expanded free trade. Ronald Reagan opened that door, and he blew it wide open with adding Mexico to NAFTA. And by the end of his term, we had lost 1 million jobs to NAFTA, to Mexico, you know, in Canada, mostly Mexico. And he opened up China, you know, virtual free trade with China by giving China preferred nation trading rights. And we lost 880,000 jobs into China. And then the trade deficit, you know, the Commerce Department rule of every $1 billion of trade deficit, you lose 13,000-15,000 jobs. Trade deficit, we lost another 1.2 million jobs. So, you know, you look at free trade or trade-related, and there's 3 million jobs, good manufacturing jobs, lost. Gone offshore under his term. The trade deficit rises from $118 billion to $436 billion, mostly because of NAFTA and China. By the end of his term, $436 billion. Right? You know, you just multiply that times 13,000, and you know that's what the U.S. Commerce Department says is jobs lost due to trade. Okay, not a pretty job picture at all. And, you know, on the tech side, he opens this big window allowing these tech firms to bring in what's called H-1B, foreign skilled labor into the U.S. to take the tech job growth. You know, hundreds of thousands every year were allowed to come in, foreigners, and take the high-paid tech jobs. Terrible record on jobs. Yeah, the numbers, but they're poor-paying jobs. And, you know, there's some in there, of course. You know, they weren't all contingent jobs, but, you know, the bulk of them were. And that whole trend really begins under him. Of course, involuntary part-time contingent being in temps really began under Reagan. So he's a continuation of Reagan trends, you know, free trade trends, offshoring trends, loss of jobs to NAFTA and China, and trade deficit trends, contingent job trends, no different than Reagan. Tax cut trends, no different than Reagan. Income inequality and stagnant pay, wage trends, same as Reagan. What about benefits? Well, healthcare benefits, healthcare spending increases 60% under under Bill Clinton compared to 400% under Reagan. So not as bad. Well, but, you know, the slowdown in the increase in spending is largely because corporations stop offering health insurance coverage. At the beginning, 63% of all corporations offered health insurance. By the end, only 45% did. And we had 31 million uninsured at the beginning of Bill Clinton's term and 44 million at the end of his term uninsured, despite managed health care. Now, that proposal of Hillary, right? And by the way, in 1 year, he redefines what's uninsured and reduces the 44 million at the end of his term to only 39 million. You know, redefinition. Redefinition is how you get rid of the uninsured. What about pensions? Under Bill Clinton, 401ks, those covered under 401ks rise from 18 million to 42 million by the end of his term. 42 million people now have 401ks, many of them converted defined benefit pensions to these phony 401ks. Right. And he also allows what were called contribution holidays. Companies didn't have to put money into their pension funds. They could phony up what the returns were on their pension funds, and that was an excuse that they didn't have to put money in. Or they could take money out. They could draw money out of their pension funds and use it to pay their corporation's share of rising health care premiums. You see, so, you know, you just drag the money out of pension funds, don't put any contributions into the pension funds. Well, no wonder by the time we get to George W. Bush, the pension funds, the defined benefit funds, are crashing everywhere, right? He sets it up. He allows it to happen. And, of course, we get all this financial deregulation under him. The Oil Commodities Futures Act in 2000, right? The Graham-Bliley Act in 1999 that repeals Glass-Steagall. Right, that's all on his watch. You know, the big deregulation accelerates under his watch, and he even lets Citigroup, who's running his treasury, you know, Robert Rubin from Citigroup's running treasury during the period, even before the repeal of Glass-Steagall that says investment banks cannot be merged with deposit banks, commercial banks, right, and commercial banks can't buy shadow banks and investment banks, insurance companies, and so forth. He lets it happen, you know. Citigroup buys Travelers Insurance, even though it was illegal at the time, but they were given retroactive exemption from that act. Right? And then we get the dot-com bust at the end of his term. Right? And in the meantime, we get welfare reform. Anyone on welfare has to go on the street. So, financial deregulation, you know, is part of his heritage, his legacy. Well, that began under Reagan, and he just, you know, expanded it. And, of course, George Bush will come along and expand this all even further. And what about Social Security? You know, by the time he leaves, there's this $2.3 trillion surplus in Social Security Trust Fund. And he proposes that, okay, let's invest that in the stock market. That was his proposal first. And George Bush, you know, would run with that to privatize Social Security. Well, Bill Clinton opened that door. He said, of course, you know, the government will invest it in the stock market. You know, you can imagine what would happen to Social Security today if under Clinton and George W. Bush that money had been invested in the stock market, you know. And, of course, you know, all these Republican candidates today are saying the same thing. They're going to reform Social Security and let it invest in the stock market. Okay, those are the real legacies of Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. You heard it here. These are facts. This is data. No, this isn't rhetoric. It's all based on reality. And now we have this election coming up. Interesting election. And we'll talk about Trump and Hillary here after we have the next round of nominations. But I think people are underestimating Trump and overestimating Hillary. But what if they... deny Trump the nomination. What happens? You may see a lot of spin-off third party efforts going on here. We'll talk about this next week. Okay, this is Jack Rasmussen, Alternative Visions. You heard the true legacy of Reagan and Clinton here. Okay, next week.